Okay, hello Chris. Welcome to Long Property. Wonderful. Thanks for having me. We're pleased to have you here. So I'm here with Chris Gray, another of Australia's leading property experts. Chris is a well-known speaker, an author and TV presenter, and he's also the creator of Your Empire, which is a successful buyer's agency in Sydney. We'll hear a lot more about it in this short interview. But today we're really going to talk about Chris's philosophies on investing and some of the lessons that he's learned along the way in his own journey. So Chris, to kick it off, can I just get you to introduce yourself quickly and tell us a little bit about your media involvement and also what you do at Your Empire?
Yeah, sure. So, my name's Chris Gray. I'm an accountant. So I started investing at 22, basically semi-retired out of Deloitte at 31. And then everyone said, "Oh, how'd you do it?" So I started teaching them, and I had nothing to do during the day. So I started doing extras on TV, which then got me into hosting on TV because they saw I had a specialty kind of interest. And then a lot of people said, "Oh, they see me on TV. They see me kind of in the fast cars and not working for a living." And they said, "Can you just do it for us?" So the buyer's agents business really just came out of people saying, "Look, if it's good enough for you, buy me one at the same time, and I'm happy to pay the money because you're going to buy it better at a cheaper price and it'll be better performing." So now I'm 45. We probably buy anywhere from 50 to 100 units a year, spend $5 or $10 million doing renovations. I do Sky once a week. I'm in the papers. We do two or three columns a month. And then I'm probably overseas about once a month for business or just traveling or learning. And I spend a lot of time with entrepreneurs just trying to learn new stuff.
Fantastic. Well, there's a lot to talk about there, so we'll try and squeeze in some of the best bits. Now, you mentioned that in the early days, at least, a lot of people made comments to the effect of, "Good enough for you, can you buy me one at the same time?" Obviously, there's a whole heap involved in the property investment process, but I think your services are really targeted towards the time-poor professional that is willing and comfortable to outsource a lot of the work to the relevant experts in the field. Is that right?
Yeah, that's true. Because when I set up the business, I'm very much about leverage and efficiency and doing things smarter ways. So I thought, if you've got someone without a job and you're trying to make them rich, it's really, really hard because, first of all, you've got to teach them how to do it, and they've got to find the money, and then they've got to put it into practice. And so at Deloitte, I was surrounded by all these high income earners that maybe earned from 100 to 500, maybe even $1 million. And I thought, surely it's got to be easier to persuade those guys because they've already got the money. They just need to know how to do it. And so I wasn't looking at changing the world or anything like that. I just thought, well, my real money comes from my properties increasing, but it's good to have a business because it gives me cash flow and serviceability, which the banks want to lend me more money. So why don't I pick the lowest hanging fruit, and that's, well, let's get suits that have got high incomes that want to buy property, don't know who to trust and want someone to do it for them. And me being a fellow suit and an investor, then the link should be a lot easier.
Yeah, absolutely. So let's then talk a little bit about your investment philosophy, I guess your personal investment philosophy, but also one that you'd be talking to clients about through the business. Having read your book, and we'll get to the book or perhaps later in the discussion. Your philosophy seems centered around the traditional buy and hold strategy, Chris. You're specifically targeting growth assets, and the idea is that you'll continually refinance your properties to, I guess, cash flow some of the short-term losses, fund additional purchases, minimize tax. Is that like a fairly decent overview?
You know it almost better than me. So
Yeah.
look, from when I started at 22, then obviously knew nothing about property, but I just thought if you buy good places and have good tenants, i.e. kind of high income professionals, they're always going to pay their rent on time because they don't want their boss finding out that they've been evicted or something like that. So that was where my philosophy came from. And I guess I was one of those people. So I was studying accounting. So I then worked out is when you go and sell a property, there's obviously lots of taxes and paying agents and stamp duties. So I think at the age of 24, I discovered the ability to refinance, and it was almost unspoken of in those days. So it was very, very early on, but it was just a no-brainer because I guess my skill is I look at the mathematics, and the mathematics just make a lot of sense to me, whereas a lot of people are confused by those kind of things. So that got me into the refinance versus not sell and go for the long term.
Yep.
Because if you've got a good property, why would you ever sell it? And then I guess what I really got into learning later on was to not buy in the CBD because there's no limit of supply and not many people want to live in the heart of the CBD. Mm-hmm. Whereas if you go kind of 5 to 15Ks out, that's where all the young professionals want to be. There's typically three-story height limit, so there's no more supply of property. So even though they debate this kind of housing affordability and wages not keeping up with property prices, I think the exception to the rule is if you've got an area with no supply of property and massive demand from young professionals with lots of money, the prices have got to rise. And so like a Bondi Beach is a really easy example. And if you're buying around the median price, i.e. say $1 million for Sydney, then 80% of the local population can afford to buy it or rent it, so you've always got a lot of demand.
Yeah,
it's really those simple things that make it work. So a lot of people, I say, it's like my strategy is so simple, but it's too simple for most clever people. Because most people are really trying to think, this has got to be complicated. If property was that easy, then everyone would do it. But everyone doesn't do it because they think, oh, it's got to be more complicated. So I haven't timed the markets. I've just bought in, and I'm really not that clever, but I'm just a doer. And that's what makes the money, is I've just gone and done it.
Yeah, fantastic. So let's talk about a couple of things, Chris, I guess just extending from that overarching strategy in the context of the current Sydney property market. We're just talking a little off air, and I've read your book, which is terrific, and I'd actually highly recommend to any of the long property audience that the book is called Effortless Empire. And Chris, in that book, summarizes much of what we've just discussed. I think it was first published, correct me if I'm wrong, Chris, maybe seven odd years ago, 2008.
Yes, it was literally, the only reason I know is there's a picture of my son on the back cover, and he was literally only a few months old. I had a quote that I got off Anthony Bell, who gave me permission to use it, to say that when my son turns 21, an average price property in Sydney or Australia will be $4 million. And of course, no one would believe that. But at the time, it's $500,000. So in 7 years' time, we're saying it doubled to $1 million. 14, it turned to $2 million, and then 21, $4 million. And everyone say there's no way that's going to happen. But we reproduced the book last year. The only thing I changed in there was the average example went from 500 to $1 million. So it was literally dead on the day. And we're
so on track.
There. Yeah. But nothing else has changed. And so much has changed since 2008, like all the GFC stuff, high interest rates, low interest rates, foreign buyers, negative gearing potentially coming out, all this kind of stuff. And the book still says, look, just buy it. The tax doesn't really matter. It's a bonus. And I don't buy in the areas where the foreigners do, where there is lots of ups and downs. So I don't think anything's changed for me in the last 10 years or even 20 years, to be honest.
Yeah, there you go. So, so obviously Sydney over the last few years, though, has experienced quite significant price growth. Has that perhaps affected not so much the higher level strategy, but perhaps when it comes to, say, the actual asset selection within the suburbs that you concentrate in? For example, might you look for a slightly, you're obviously just buying established dwellings, but might you look for something that's a little bit, more run down, giving you the ability to manufacture some of your own capital growth through renovations, et cetera?
Yeah, not really, because, sometimes we've done 30 or 40 renos in a year, and other years we've done one or two because whatever came up on the market didn't need a reno. And so I'd always say I'd rather buy fully renovated today than buy unrenovated tomorrow, because tomorrow could take me 6 or 12 months. Now, on our renos, because we're buying in sophisticated areas, you're never going to find that kind of diamond in the rough. So say we bought $1 million property, to make numbers easy, and we put 80 grand in, it might rise in value, say 100, 120. So you might make 20 or 40 grand, which is nice. But if it took you a year to find that property and the market was moving at 10% a year, well, already it's cost you 1.1 before you've even done the reno. So it's a false economy waiting for that time. And so, sure, I love adding value, but it's just buy the property. That is the biggest thing.
Yeah. Very interesting. So, and that probably just speaks to another point around certain people that are more interested in timing the market. Your approach is very much just get in. It's time in the market that's most relevant.
Because, look, we've got clients now that don't look at the properties, that they treat it like a spreadsheet, and we buy for them within 2 weeks. We've got other clients on the books that they've been there for a year because they're trying to get that second bathroom. They're trying to find this amazing thing, or it takes them a week or two to make a decision, whereas the ones that are making the money are the ones that will make a decision within an hour because they've thought it all out before. We've gone through all the pros and cons. Yeah. And effectively, out of the 50 or 100 properties we buy, they're all technically the same. They all look slightly differently, but as long as they're in a blue-chip suburb, within a K of the beach, it's on evaluation, we've got a building and a strata inspection done and a property management report, it's accountant, it's box-ticking.
Yeah.
And that's where the money is.
So you've got clients, you've discussed the strategy, they're comfortable, as you said, it's spreadsheet-based, they're on board. The reason that they'd have to make decisions so quickly, is that because, Chris, you're buying properties on behalf of your clients off market occasionally, and therefore it just kind of requires that speed of execution?
100%. So quite often they call off markets or silent sales. So say, for instance, a photographer goes in on a Monday to take pictures. They're going to go and get all the copy done and for the advert, and they're going to get it on the internet for, say, Thursday night, and the first opens on the Saturday. Because of the relationship we've got with the agent, we'll go in with the photographer on the Monday, and if we think it's a good property in advance, we'll bring our valuer and building inspector with us to save those extra days. Now, even though we buy the same things, we know what the price is, but we want the valuer to prove it down to the dollar. Mm-hmm. And it takes him, even a registered valuer, maybe 2 or 3 days to do that proper report, because he orders the strata reports of all the comparables, so that's a really, really thorough job. And so we're then trying to buy it maybe on Wednesday night or Thursday morning. And that's the thing, because we can buy it for, say, $1 million. Mm-hmm. But if it hit the internet and 100 people saw it and they're fed up because they've been looking 6 months, they might just ring the agent and say, look, I'll pay $1,050,000 sight unseen. And so we can't compete with those emotional people. And so it's a deal on, say, Wednesday at $1 million. But then on Thursday, it could be $1,050,000. So we'll say to the client, look, if you need longer to make a decision, this isn't the property for you because the price will jump on Thursday night. Yeah. So we need to offer it to a client that we know that can make a decision that isn't going to live in it, and maybe it's their fifth or sixth one rather than the first. So trying to get a first home buyer around that mentality is very, very hard.
Sure.
And we only want our clients to do it when they're comfortable. So we'll say to someone that needs more time, this isn't the right one for you. Let's wait for one that will definitely go on the market because they want to have two opens, and then we'll try and buy it. And look, we might not get it for $1 million, but we might pay 10 or 20 or 30 or something. So they're still getting a good deal, and they're not being forced into a decision, but we've just got to work with different personalities.
Yeah, that makes complete sense. Okay, Chris, so I want to segue into some of the personal experiences that you've had investing both, well, in the Australian market, but I know that you've invested abroad as well. What we typically do on long properties, we try and deep dive into a particular investment that perhaps was memorable to our guests in some way. Maybe it was an investment of your own, or perhaps an investment that you've made on behalf of a client. But something that I guess has just helped shape the way you look at current opportunities and your kind of supports your investment philosophy. So is there one that you've got in mind, Chris, that you could perhaps elaborate on and just talk through with our audience in a bit more detail?
Sure. Look, there's a whole bunch of different ones, and they've all got a different story and a different learning. But let's start off with the very first one I bought, and this this really kind of teaches a lot. So when I was at 22, I earned £10,000, which was like $20,000. So it's absolutely nothing. And I was lucky enough to inherit $10,000 as well. So I had a 20 grand deposit effectively, and I earned 20 grand. So basically that would mean that I could effectively borrow enough money three times of that, a $60,000 to $80,000 property, which gets you absolutely nothing. And so this is why most young people wouldn't buy one, because they'd get the most horrible studio or one-bedroom unit, and they'd have no money for going out and doing other stuff. And so what I then worked out is I fell in love with a three-bedroom house, and I thought, this is amazing. This is the kind of property I'm accustomed to live in. But obviously, I can't afford it. So I then worked the numbers out, and long story short, I worked out that if I could get the mortgage from the bank that was seven times my income, if I then rented two rooms out to two friends, the rents in those days were like 10 or 12%, I could actually live for free. And so I then went to my dad and I said, look, Dad, look at these two equations. Crappy one-bedroom unit, can't afford it. Nice three-bedroom house, really good suburb, right in the heart of town. It actually, I get it for free. And I actually bought so well, I made 2 years' salary overnight. So it's a 100 grand property that I bought for 80, which in Australian dollars would say a $200,000 property, and I bought for 160. So I could buy a home, get it for free, and earn 2 years' salary overnight.
So long as you keep your friends and make sure that those are the rent.
Exactly. And then I think I even hired my brother for about £1 an hour and one of his university mates to then sand the floors and decorate it. But that was the real learning, is sometimes going the complete opposite way can be kind of the cheapest way. I then worked out 2 years later how I could refinance the money out of that, which was unheard of in the 90s, and I got a free Porsche. And again, I couldn't afford a Porsche, but I could afford the interest repayments over 30 years. And because it was a second-hand old Porsche, it didn't devalue. And so people would then say, oh, yeah, but you've just added, say, £15,000 to your mortgage. But, yeah, the property price has moved up by 30. So if I sold the property, had the 30 grand, paid the tax, people would say that's okay. But then I'd have no asset. So what I've learned with refinancing, and I go through it in the book because I made it a bit quick, but refinancing is the same as selling your property to the bank, buying it back the next day, but without any of the transaction costs. And so rather than pay the transaction costs, I'd rather pay that in a Porsche.
Yeah, I love it. So just extending from that, there are a couple of points. The first is, I'm guessing, but I'd love you to elaborate, I'm guessing that you're fairly interest rate agnostic by and large when it comes to refinancing. Like, you need to find banks that are willing to support your objectives, and if there's a bank that is willing to kind of understand you as an investor, refinance your lending and ultimately give you more money, that's far preferable to you in comparison to, say, saving 5 or 10 basis points here and there.
100%. So late last year, I refinanced $10 million, and I didn't ask them what the rate was, and I still don't know what the rate is, and we're 6 months later. Which most people say you're mad, but it's, if you lend me enough money to buy an extra $1 million of property, I think I can make $50,000 or $100,000 a year off that. Yep. So who cares if overall I've even been charged $5,000, $10,000, or $20,000?
Yeah.
Like in the GFC, I bought a block of units and I was paying 10.5% commercial rates and probably 20 or 30 grand arrangements fees. And people are saying, that's mad, I can borrow at 6 or 7%. I said, well, no, you can't, because once you've got more than three in the block, then it's seen as commercial. And I made $1 million on that in 3.5 months. So if you make $1 million on top of your costs, who cares if the interest rate's 20%?
Yeah.
And this is what developers and builders do. They might pay 30 or 40% interest, but it's only on a small proportion of the debt, enough to get them going, that then they make bigger amounts. So again, a common phrase I always say is, our parents' generation were always trying to get rich by saving money. What's the cheapest thing? Mm. The new generation is how much money do I make? So what's the net difference, not what's the cost?
Makes complete sense. I think it's difficult driving that message home for less experienced investors, but those that have been around perhaps for a bit longer and enjoyed success in their investing, they understand that a lot more easily.
And again, it's the thought of that three-bedroom house versus the one-bedroom unit. So if you had to pay a premium to have really high gearing, or to pay lender's mortgage insurance to borrow 95% rather than 80, but that allowed you to get into a bigger, better property that made more money, then maybe that's the calculation they should work out to say, well, hey, it is better.
Yeah, agree completely. So just lastly then, Chris, tell me a little bit more about the idea of rent vesting, because I know there's you've got a long history with that idea, and I guess there's a lot of similarities between this concept, its origins, and also this first story that you've just spoken about.
Yeah, look, I'm probably the most well-known renter in Australia, I would say. But I wish I could have invented the word rent vesting and copyrighted it. But I think it was actually someone from LJ Hooker that came out with it. So the concept of rent vesting basically means is most people can't afford to live in the house that they want, because we've never got enough money, and most of our dreams are always to be in a bigger, better house in a better suburb. So the thought process is rather than just go and buy the house in the suburb you can afford, is why not go and rent in the best place that you can afford? And as rent money is only dead money if you don't invest the equivalent elsewhere. Mm-hmm. So concentrate on putting your money into where you're going to get the best return. That could be business shares or property, but saying property, it's buying an area that, say, if you live in Queensland or something and you thought Sydney is going to get you a better return, put the money into Sydney, into a Bondi Beach, and then you go and rent on the Gold Coast if that's where you want to live.
Yep.
And so another way to think of it is, as you buy, say you play Monopoly, which most people have, is buy lots of those little greenhouses, because it's cheaper and easier to get the little ones.
Yep.
And then go and rent the house on, or the hotel on Mayfair or Park Lane. And the reason this works is, say, and I'll use Sydney numbers just because it's easier. Say on a $1 million Bondi unit, it's going to cost you $1 million. Lots of people in the middle of summer want to rent those, so the rent goes higher. And typically, mm-hmm. you'll get 4 to 5% rent.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas if you then in turn bought, say, you wanted a $3 million house in Sydney, which doesn't get you a lot, rather than buy the $3 million house, if you bought three $1 million units, or even two of them, you could then rent those out for, say, $900 a week each. So say you've even got two. So you've then got $1,800 coming in.
Yep.
Then when you go to rent the expensive house, not many people can afford the rent on that. And the ones that can afford it don't want to do it because the perception is poor people rent, so the rent comes down. So, for instance, I'm renting a place in Darling Point for $1,500 that is worth $3.5-4 million. So I'd much rather have two $1 million investments, so I've got $2 million in property, have $1,800 a week coming in and rent from those, spend $1,500 on my place. I'm living in a $4 million property rather than the $2 million. I'm making $300 a week, and then my $2 million mortgage is tax deductible.
Yep.
So I basically, so, and again, yep, the book goes through
sense.
This,
yep.
is wherever you can afford to buy, you can afford to rent somewhere three times more expensive if you can get those kind of those rough numbers that I went through to work for you.
Yeah, yeah. No, it makes complete sense. What would your advice be to somebody that understands that concept but doesn't necessarily want to go so upmarket in terms of the property that they rent, so they don't have to live in the large exclusive, you know, property that obviously has the higher investment yield? Can you still get the economics to work?
Yeah. So say you bought $1 million property, should you have it as a home or an investment? Well, if you have it as a home, sure, it's capital gains free, but if you never sell, you never get that benefit. Mm-hmm. So my mum, for instance, she's been in the home for 45 years. She's had zero benefit from capital gains.
Yeah.
Whereas if you rented it out, then, and say you got $800 or $900 a week in, you could then rent next door for exactly the same money, because assuming it's exactly the same property.
Yep.
So you're effectively still living in the same property, but suddenly now the difference between the rent and the mortgage, i.e. all your mortgage, your strata fees, your repairs and maintenance, all of that is then tax deductible, and you then get that back in your wages every year or every week.
Yeah.
But
got it.
It works much, much better if you're then getting the arbitrage of you're renting your little units out at 4 or 5% and you're renting somewhere else at 2, 3 or 4. That's where you make the real money.
Yeah, got it. And enjoy a terrific lifestyle along the way.
Yeah, so I just think is, sure, rather than live in my own $2 million, I'd rather live in the $4 million. Sure, I don't own it, but then, to be honest, I don't care. So when we have parties or the kids are making a mess, or I go and travel a lot, I don't worry about home maintenance. I spend zero of my weekend time doing chores. So if you love looking after your house, great, but I don't. And so being in a rental, I don't have to worry about any of it.
Yeah, got it. Fantastic, Chris. Well, just to finish off then, perhaps just a few concluding remarks then on the current Sydney market. Obviously, there was a slight retraction at the beginning of the year off enormous price growth that we've seen over the last 2.5 to 3 years, but the fundamentals of Sydney are still strong. Now I suppose price growth has resumed at what's probably a much more sustainable level. How do you see things shaping up in Sydney over the next 3 to 5 years?
Sure. So look, even though I'm on the news and I write the papers, I don't listen to any of it. Because
right.
All of these stats, you can read so much into it. Like just in, again, I use Bondi as a good example. Mm. There's so many different markets. So there'll be one stat or maybe two stats, houses and units for growth. Well, first mm-hmm. of all, they're just looking over a month. And there's $10 million units down at Bondi Beach and there's $1 million ones. There's semis up Bondi Road for $2 or $3 million. There's massive apartment Meriton Towers where there's 500 or 1,000 in the tower up at Bondi Junction and it all comes under the same postcode.
Mm-hmm.
There's some that are 500 metres to the beach and there's some that are a 2K walk and you've got to go and park and pay the meter. So
yep.
There's so many different markets. You've got to understand what's going on in your market at that particular time. And so the way I read the market or my market is I see how many clients I've got on and I see how few properties there are and I see the prices they go at auction when we don't manage to get them off market. Mm-hmm. And that's how I know exactly what's happening in the market. So I'd say in the last 3 or 4 years, there's almost been no change. It's been really, really strong. Now, there's always one or two properties that will go and sell for 20 or 30% more because you've got a few neighbours all arguing they all want it.
Yeah.
But just in general, I think the market has been stable and I don't think it has been ridiculous, stupid growth. So the 500 hasn't gone to a million overnight.
Mm-hmm.
And so we're always buying on a bank fail, which is conservative. So we've just got to consistently buy on that bank fail. And look, sometimes at auction, they'll go a million and 50 or 1.1, sometimes even 1.2, but it's not the ones we're buying. So I don't really care.
Yeah, yeah, got it.
So I don't think there's going to be a major change because we've still got lots of clients coming on. We're obviously always happy to have more. There's no more properties, but there never was any. Even the GFC, there was no two-bedroom units with parking. And so I just think that middle level of the market is just nice and solid. It's not that volatile. We're not going to make 20 or 30% returns overnight, but at the same time, I don't think it's going to drop 10 or 20%. Whereas as you go more expensive and maybe cheaper and the no parking and the bigger blocks, those ones will be more volatile. So it's just picking the market and the strategy that you understand that you really want to be in.
Yeah, yeah. And there's probably a lot that our listeners can learn from just this idea of not reading too heavily into all of the news and media and reports because often it's heavily generalized, isn't it? And it could be completely irrelevant for the markets that people are actually looking to buy in.
Yeah. So look, it's either really generalized and they talk about the property market and there isn't. There's hundreds of them.
Mm.
Even in New South Wales and there's hundreds of different micro markets.
Mm.
Then you've got to look at who's talking about the report. So the big reports now, they're talking about, the foreigners aren't getting home loans. Well, that doesn't matter to me because foreigners don't buy second-hand properties in Bondi.
Mm-hmm.
They buy brand spanking new ones in the CBDs and the Chatswoods and the Gold Coast.
Mm-hmm.
So if you're in that market, yes, you need to be aware of that. But again, is you've then got the sensationalism of the journalist or the newspaper because they need to – my story doesn't sell because it's boring. I'm saying it's been fine for 10 years. I reckon it's fine for the next 10 years. It doesn't sell a paper. They need to have big stories to say – what suddenly changed in the last 5 minutes because we need something to talk about. And that's the problem with media is they've got to talk about something.
Yeah. So in terms of the show then that you host, Chris, your strategies for making that more fair and balanced? I mean, obviously, having watched it often, you're often just, giving examples of particular properties and markets and opportunities, and people can learn through these experiences and these examples of what you guys discuss. Is that fair?
Yeah, so we're not. So first of all, it's a news channel. So it's on Sky Business. So it is more of a serious channel versus a current affair type thing, which I've also done as well, which is the scare tactics. This is a sensationalizing kind of thing going on, and you've got to be aware of it.
Yeah.
So we're trying to put a bit of balance on there. Look, we're joking around and playing around at the same time. But most of the other people on there, like I have Charles Tarby from Century 21, Tom Panos from News Corp, like Anthony Bell, they're all serious people that aren't into hype. We're not trying to flog anything off the back of the show.
Yeah.
And we're saying, look, do worry about interest rates. They are low. They will go higher, guaranteed. So save some money now or don't get into too much debt because things will change in the future. So we're trying to put perspective around some of these bigger stories to say, I personally don't care if they take negative gearing out because, sure, I like it and I get tax back, but it's a bonus for investing, not the reason for it.
Sure.
And sure, there might be a bit of a hiccup if they take it out, but we all said that with GST. Like, when GST came in, we added 10% to prices. Everyone thought the world was going to come to an end. Now no one knows. And like in the UK, I just went back there a few weeks ago, that's now, it's like 20% in the UK. So they go and chuck it in, and then it creeps up from 10 to 20, and no one notices because it's not big news anymore. And I think negative gearing is a classic story like that. Look, there will be a blip, but 5 or 10 years time, then it might be back in and no one cares anyway. So that's why I don't worry about these things. I just think, sure, you've got to be aware of them, but deal with it when it comes because it hasn't come for the last 10 or 15 years.
Yeah, there you go. Fantastic. Well, Chris, I think we'll leave it there. Really appreciate your time. I look forward to following with great interest. And we'll be looking forward to see how long it does take Sydney to reach those prices that Mr. Bell predicted a long time ago.
Wonderful. Thanks a lot for having me.
Thanks very much for your time, Chris. All the best.